A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium, Episode 44, Unceasing Lamentations. A note on the previous episode, listener B spotted that I made the rather classic mistake of mixing up AD and BC. So Pompey actually brought Syria into the empire about 675 years before the Persians captured Antioch, Emesa, and Apamea. Not 550 years, as I said. As disastrous as those statistics sound, as 612 AD became 613, I imagine the majority of Byzantine citizens did not realize the true extent of the collapse they were living through. The men and women of Syria and Armenia were the ones closest to the fire, and certainly their lives had been rocked by the string of Persian victories. But even with the occupation of three of the major cities of Syria, why would you conclude that the sky was falling? Persia and Byzantium had been at war on and off for a century now. Marches and countermarches had churned the sands of the Near East for 30 of the last 40 years. The sack of Antioch by Khusro I was still living in the public consciousness, as were the Byzantine victories under Maurice. And more than a knowledge of military history, the certainty that the one true God looked after the Romans was what kept men's faith in the status quo. Rome had created the civilized world, and Jesus Christ had been born, killed, and risen within it to convert and purify it for God's ends. Perhaps the Lord was testing his people. Perhaps he was punishing them for their sins. But as long as they stayed true in their faith, he would reward them with victory. As you may remember, Maurice's two most successful generals were Priscus and Philippicus. Since their heyday, the empire had repeatedly purged its experienced military leaders. Phocas killed several, or sent others into retirement and replaced them with family members or those loyal to him. When Heraclius came to power, he naturally got rid of these men, and so the empire was left with a huge vacuum in military experience just when they needed it most. With Priscus packed off to a monastery, the emperor called upon Philippicus to take off the robes forced upon him by Phocas and resume his post as the empire's senior general. Senior being the operative word. We don't have much biographical information to call on, but it's likely that Philippicus was in his 50s or 60s by now. His loyalty wasn't in question. He had worked closely with Heraclius Senior, but rustiness was definitely a possibility after a decade under holy orders. With this consideration in mind, or perhaps just the pressing need to save his empire and his reputation, Heraclius took the decision to go with Philippicus east and lead troops himself. The first emperor to do so since Theodosius I, back in the late 4th century. The Persians had to be pushed back from Syria, So Heraclius took charge of the army in Anatolia and sent word to Nicetas to advance north from Palestine. Perhaps a pincer move would trap Shahrazad's army and force them to return home. A big problem with this plan, though, was what to do about Shahin's army, the one the Byzantines had failed to trap in Caesarea. Shahin was operating from Armenia and would now either be free to cause carnage in Anatolia or indeed circle around Heraclius' army and trap him. A detachment of imperial forces were thus broken off and given to Philippicus to try and hold Shahin off during the campaign. When spring arrived, Heraclius led his army through the Taurus Mountains, down across Cilicia, and met Shahrazad in battle outside Antioch. Both sides suffered heavy losses, but as had happened the previous year, the Persians were able to retreat to the safety of the city when they wanted to rest. The Byzantines had nowhere to go and were unable to gain any significant advantage. Nicetas' force also failed to make a telling contribution. Presumably he had struggled to get past the garrisons guarding Apamea and Emesa. Neither Heraclius or Nicetas were experienced generals, and if there was an opportunity to inflict a telling defeat on the Persians, then neither were able to exploit it. Philippicus, on the other hand, showed the value of his knowledge of conditions. Shahin continued his attacks on Anatolia by capturing the city of Melitene. Unable to match his foe in battle, Philippicus outflanked him, marching into Persian Armenia to do some raiding of his own. The rugged terrain was not easy for large armies to traverse, and Shahin lost many men chasing Philippicus's tail, as the old general wisely kept away from the Persians before retreating home later in the summer. That tiny tactical victory, though, was no more than a band-aid on an open wound. With control of the major Syrian cities came the farmlands which surrounded them. Having failed to oust the Persians, Heraclius was forced to retreat back to Anatolia, and Nicetas' losses were significant as he abandoned the Levant and withdrew to Egypt. The rest of Syria and Palestine now lay open to the Persians. Shahrazad wasted no time, and by autumn had captured Damascus, which left the road to Jerusalem open. The cities en route, such as Caesarea Maritima or Tiberias, began to make deals with the Persians, accepting a garrison in exchange for peaceful occupation. It seems likely that the large Jewish population of parts of the area were actively aiding Persian armies. A large Jewish community had flourished within the Persian Empire for some time, and many welcomed the invaders with the hope that the isolation and the persecution of the Christian world might be over. As Shahrazad's army approached Jerusalem, many Jews joined in a sort of triumphal march toward the Holy City. They must have dreamt of reclaiming it from the followers of Jesus. Sensing the inevitability of Persian conquest, the Byzantine Christians inside surrendered and accepted a Persian garrison. It seemed clear from the experience of Syria that the Persians were not here to sack and destroy, but to take control and govern peacefully. So the accommodation was made, and the Persian troops took control of the city. What happened over the winter of 613, we can only guess. Tensions must have been very high. In a place which was both the citadel of Jewish independence and the site of Christ's triumph over death, the arguments must have raged for months. Rumour and fear over what the Persians and the Jews might do to the city or to its inhabitants must have been debated. Perhaps local Jews added to the scaremongering by announcing grandiose plans for restoration. Maybe it was political concern. Had the Christian Empire's most sacred place been surrendered too easily? Was this treasonous collusion rather than sensible pacifism? We just don't know. But come spring 614, Shahrazad took his army south to continue the conquest of Byzantine Palestine. And behind him, the Christians of Jerusalem expelled their Persian soldiers and locked the gates behind them. Doubtless this involved killing some of them, and allegedly many of the city's Jews were murdered or shown the door. Shahrvaraz promptly turned around, marched back to the city, and put it under siege. Whether or not the general was furious at this rebellion, or simply shrugged at the necessity, he prepared to sack Jerusalem. It only made sense to send the message to the Roman cities of the east that to accept occupation meant peace, and to resist meant destruction. The siege lasted 3 desperate weeks, as the inhabitants realized that no relieving army was on its way. By late May, the Persians forced their way in. The sack lasted 3 days, which was by no means abnormal, but the accounts that came out were horrific. Now, the accounts of the Christian chroniclers should be taken with large amounts of salt, as they describe the destruction of the city and the slaughter of its inhabitants. They claim that few buildings were left standing, that upwards of 80,000 people were killed or enslaved, and that Jews poured out of local villages to take revenge on the Christians of the city, targeting nuns and monks for particularly brutal treatment. Most of the major churches were destroyed, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, built by Constantine over Christ's tomb, was gutted by fire. The Persians removed the most holy relics from the city and took them back to Ctesiphon. The numbers killed and the extent of the damage were clearly exaggerated. It's doubtful that Jerusalem's population was anywhere near 80,000 at this time. The city was definitely sacked, though. Mass graves have been uncovered showing hundreds of men, women, and children who were killed or worse. Some Jews were naturally involved. But it seems unlikely that the Persians would have wanted to level the city, and the care they showed the Christian artifacts they shipped home demonstrates an awareness of Byzantine sensitivities. The Persians planned on governing these people and absorbing them into their empire, so to mercilessly crush their spirits was not their first priority. Thousands of prisoners were taken, and as had become standard practice, many were marched back to Persian territory to set up new colonies. The patriarch Zacharias was amongst them, to add to the humiliation. And humiliation this was. News of the sack of the holy city shocked the Byzantine world. The future patriarch of Jerusalem, Sophronius, wrote, "The waves of tears that flow from my eyes are insufficient for such a great funeral." While the Chronicon Paschal notes that we suffered a calamity which deserves unceasing lamentations. Refugees poured out of Palestine and Syria toward Egypt, straining the resources available in Alexandria. The spilling of Christian blood, the murder of holy men and women, even Shahrvaraz's decision to hand over the administration of the city to the Jews were all terrible news for the Byzantines. But the removal of the holiest of Christian relics to Ctesiphon, the capital of a people who worshipped fire, was a hammer blow. You may recall from the History of Rome podcast that Constantine's mother, Helena, went on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land and spent some of her time uncovering the exact locations of Jesus' death and interment. She also found important items associated with his suffering, like the lance and sponge used during the crucifixion, and the true cross itself. Whether or not these items were authentic is less important than the fact that it was believed that they were. After finding the true cross on which Jesus was crucified, she divided it into 2 parts. One half was sent back to Constantinople, and the other was kept in a silver case in the Church of the Resurrection in Jerusalem. The loss of the true cross, on top of all the other calamities, was seen as a clear sign of divine displeasure. A more staggering blow to Heraclius's prestige is hard to imagine. Incidentally, the arrival of the True Cross was apparently received by cheering crowds in Ctesiphon, where many Christians now lived. A large community of Nestorians, one of the schismatic beliefs the Byzantines had forced out of the empire, lived amongst the Persians. Back in Constantinople, the sack seems to have had a shattering effect on morale, with many finally understanding the true extent of the empire's woes. The Jews were naturally vilified and accused of everything from treason and treachery to murder and sadism. In a deeply religious society, it was only natural for people to ask why God had abandoned them. Why would he allow the fire-worshipping Persians to carry off the relics of his only son? And in a society where the culture of power was one that proclaimed from every coin to every column that the emperor was God's representative on earth, well, some began to ask what Heraclius had done to anger their lord. And the answer to some seemed obvious. Last episode I talked about the marriage between Heraclius and Eudocia, which bore two healthy heirs within the first 2 years of marriage. But in August 612, tragedy struck when Eudocia died, apparently from epilepsy. Heraclius swiftly found a new consort, and it was his niece, Martina, daughter of his sister, who he married within a year of Jerusalem's fall. Like Justinian choosing Theodora, we can only assume that Heraclius loved her dearly and valued her company extremely highly, because this was a deeply unpopular choice at a time when the emperor's legitimacy was being openly called into question. Although the union was not strictly illegal, it was widely considered incestuous by the public, by the church, and by members of the Heraclian family. But the emperor ignored them, and after long talks with the patriarch Sergius, he agreed to perform the marriage ceremony and crown Martina empress. Over the next few years, she became a despised figure by many in the streets. She bore Heraclius two sons who died in infancy, and the third was apparently a deaf mute. In a time of crisis, it seems men were clinging to Heraclius in the hopes that he could restore the empire's strength, but his wife was not afforded the same courtesy. Like the Jews, she was an obvious scapegoat for the ills of Romania. Putting the religious significance to one side, the loss of Syria and Palestine was obviously a deadly serious problem. The empire had been effectively split in two. The Western Field Army now had to camp behind the Taurus Mountains. It was unable to link up with Nicetas's force down in Egypt. The Persians were capturing city after city, which could soon challenge Byzantine control of the sea. The Persians did not have enough men to capture every square inch of the Levant, but soon enough their tax collectors and garrisons would begin to fan out and try and control and tap the wealth of the Roman East. This collapse of imperial control had an effect on the local Arab tribes patrolling the deserts. Despite the breakup of the Ghassanid coalition, many tribes had still received a little imperial cash to keep them friendly. But now that all deals were off, there was nothing to stop the unscrupulous amongst them from raiding and extorting the settled populations. And sure enough, soon after the Persian victories, we find reports of bishops in Palestine having to pay ransom money to Arab raiders who had kidnapped members of their flock. Over in the Balkans, an awareness that the Byzantines had largely abandoned the peninsula soon became known amongst the Slavs and Avars. Between 612 and 615, Slav settlement in Illyricum went from a trickle to a deluge. Epirus, Thessaly, and central Greece were soon occupied, with local Byzantines either fleeing or accepting that new masters had arrived. Slav confidence in their freedom of movement saw several tribes combine in yet another unsuccessful attempt to capture Thessalonica. Others took to canoes and raided the Cyclades Islands off the southern tip of Greece. The Avars had been largely quiet since Priscus's men had inflicted a crushing defeat on them in 599. We don't actually know who succeeded Bion as the Khagan. Despite the prominent role the Avars will have in the next few episodes, I'm afraid I will just have to call their leader the Khagan. Whether he was one of Bion's sons, relatives, or a nobleman from another tribe, he was doubtless motivated by revenge for the scars the Byzantines had inflicted. With news of the Slavs proceeding unmolested throughout the provinces, the Khagan amassed his forces and invaded in 615. He targeted the Byzantine towns still being garrisoned, and soon captured Nisus, Serdica, and Salona. Justinian's vanity project, Justiniana Prima, seems to have been sacked around this time as well. Many Byzantine prisoners were taken north and settled in Avar territory. When the Avars bumped into various Slavic tribes on their journeys, the Khagan made it clear that he was reasserting his authority over them. If he called for their assistance, they should give it, or else. Almost all of the Balkans was lost by the end of the decade. The Avars didn't systematically conquer the area. They weren't an organized state like the Persians, but they occupied any outposts they needed, so that any attempts to maintain trade or large-scale farming would have been in desperate danger every summer when the hordes returned looking for fresh booty. A few coastal cities held out, those that could be resupplied by sea, and lowland Thrace, the strip of farmland running down toward Constantinople, remained in imperial hands. Phocas had had to transfer many of the troops from the armies of Illyricum and Thrace east when the Persians invaded. Of the garrisons left behind, many held on to their fortified positions while the Slavs and Avars took control of the surrounding countryside, and over time they would either have to make a run for it or choose between slavery and death. It seems likely that what was left of the army of Illyricum disintegrated, while some of the army of Thrace made it back to guard the long walls. It can't have been a pressing concern for the emperor, but most of the Byzantine holdings in Spain now disappeared as well. King Sisebut of the Visigoths pressed large attacks on the area and destroyed settlements he captured to prevent them from being retaken. It was, of course, the territorial losses at home, though, that had caused a major strategic and financial crisis. The capture of Mesopotamia, Armenia, Syria, and Palestine were a seismic blow to the empire's resources. The loss of tax revenue plunged the treasury into crisis, while the dislocation in the Balkans meant the empire's prime recruiting ground was also gone. In 616, Heraclius took the steps necessary to be able to afford his remaining army and bureaucracy. He cut their pay in half. One way of achieving this saving was to return to the system of providing the men with their arms and uniforms, rather than with a cash allowance that they could spend themselves. This was, of course, one of the economies that Maurice had attempted to enact, which his men had refused. In such straitened times, the army acquiesced. For imperial bureaucrats, there was no such sop. They simply lost half their earnings. To manage the precious stores of gold he had left, Heraclius made his new payments with silver coins, minted especially for the occasion. You can see this new coin, the hexagram, on Facebook, or at thehistoryofbyzantium.com. And inscribed around the edges was the phrase, "May God help the Romans." The copper pholis was also slightly debased at this time, and these pay cuts kept the armies in the field and Heraclius on the throne. In Ravenna, the soldiers' pay had been so late that they had killed their exarch, and down in Naples a man named John of Conza rebelled and proclaimed himself emperor. However, by 617 the new exarch Eleutherius arrived with the pay, and John was executed. The Persians, however, remained on the move, and in 2 weeks' time they will put the sack of Jerusalem into perspective by marching on the Romans' most treasured possession, Egypt.